electrician upon the attack mission. Coalition, a politician get pressure. If you look in the face of the newly born, the newly born a face malnutrition. Suspicion for what is the ambition.
Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines. We'd like to invite Vijay Prashad to the show. He's the Associate Professor of International Studies at Trinity College. His books include The Karma of Black Folks and Keeping Up with the Dow Joneses. And this fall, he's going to be coming out with The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, and Dispatches from Latin America on Front Lines Against Neoliberalism. So he's going to join us today to talk about the recent elections in India, where the communists have significant victories in the regions of West Bengal and Kerala, as well as Tamil Nadu. Welcome, Vijay.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks.
How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Oh, congratulations on your second child.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, not to get so
all
personal.
All good things come in at one time.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, I think what I wanted to start off with is the reason for the show is not just for you to talk about the recent victories, but, you know, I remember going to this conference and someone said, hey, once the revolution happens, we can solve transportation in 5 minutes.
Right.
I was listening. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. You know, that it's one thing is to seize power, but we've got to understand, as those building the left and progressive movements, it means a whole nother thing to once you have it, what are you going to do with it?
Right.
So let's talk. Let's go to India. Let's talk about West Bengal. You know, we've got seven elections they've won. They've got a stronghold down there. What have they done, and how have they maintained this? And I'm assuming it's a mass question there. So start off with telling us the regions, what's the population, and what is this Communist Party that's gotten control there?
Yeah, the thing to understand is India, like the United States, is a federal system. So every state has state elections for the state assembly. And the left is very strong in three states. West Bengal, which is the same size as Iraq. It's about 25 million people.
Wow.
Kerala, significantly smaller, about half the land mass, and Tripura is the third main state where the left has electoral strength. In Tamil Nadu, where there was also an election, the left has some strength in pockets, in the agricultural regions, in the industrial belt. But it provides, you might say, the value added for the kind of liberal left political party there, and they worked in alliance together. Now, you know, the left has never won power of the central government, so it's not been able to dictate state policy as such. It's essentially in power to administer a state. And given that there are both constraints and opportunities, since 1977, the left has been in power in West Bengal, and its electoral majority has grown. Now, you know, on the face of it, you can't grow an electoral majority unless you're doing something. So unlike those who are quick to dismiss the left movement in India as a kind of new communism or a neoliberal communism, I would caution them that you don't grow these kind of majorities where 80% of the population votes and the left wins about 80% of the ballot. This was the most policed election that India has seen since 1947. You know, there were federal police officers in all stations because the opposition has accused the left of what they call booth capturing. So under such stringent lockdown conditions, the left triumphs. So what have they been able to do? Well, it's actually quite simple to tabulate. The one thing that's very important is in the 1960s and 70s, the left led a peasant struggle in West Bengal. And when coming to power in 77, the left did two things. One is they enforced that every landless tenant must have their name written down in a register. In other words, they registered landless tenancy. They made landless tenancy, which had hitherto been under the complete control of landlords, they regulated it. So that was a small reform, but it won the admiration of landless tenants who now suddenly acquired rights to their tenancy. And this, from a distance, looks like a small thing. But you have to understand, this is a major blow to feudal power in localities. It's a political question, not an economic question. You empowered landless people to say, I have rights to, you know, my work. The second thing they did is they started to build up and promote the so-called panchayat system, local self-government. So the left took local self-government, which is, you know, a bourgeois demand, and said, let's take this seriously. And the local self-government, the panchayat, has become a kind of dual power structure. So on the one hand, you have the left winning elections to the formal state structure. And on the other hand, the left has increasingly been devolving power to panchayats, including financial power.
Hmm.
So money is sent down to local self-government, which is a parallel institution. It's not the same as the local, say, assistant district magistrate, you know, that colonial structure is still in place. So they've created a dual power setup, and in the dual in the panchayat elections, the left wins astronomical victories. You know, this 80% margin is small compared to the panchayat, but sometimes they win 100% of the panchayat because they take those elections seriously and those institutions seriously, and therefore this devolution of power has been their strength. Where the left is constrained is on the ability of the left to create economic development. So politically, there have been some major gains. They've strengthened the hand of the working class and the peasantry. But on economic development, they have had to make all kinds of deals with Indonesian capital, Singaporean capital, etc. And this is where there's a great problem, is how to bring capital into the state for economic development. They have been unable to draw increased surplus from agriculture. The agricultural growth rate in West Bengal is higher than anywhere else in India. But because of the way international terms of trade function and such, the agriculture is not capable of producing significant surplus to create more economic growth in the rest of the state.
So, go back a little bit. This panchayat systems that you're talking about, where you're having dual power, how does that actually function, and how are they able to involve the population? And second, you've talked about a little bit about the class structure inside India. I mean, it's not as easy just to say it's the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, but give us a sense of the rural proletariats and the middle peasants, and how are they able to, it seems like they have a concentration in the peasantry, but they're not able to make inroads into the cities, and why is that?
Okay, let's take the first question of the panchayat. It's quite simple. What the old state structure, the state structure that exists, the mainstream state structure, is essentially a structure that operates from above. Every district in India has a district magistrate, a civil servant, who comes from a federal program. People become civil servants, they're delegated to a district. That district magistrate in that area has an enormous amount of power. They are the judicial and the executive branch. So you have a legislative, representative from an area who has some power to make, laws, but the administrative power is held by this person who monopolizes judicial and executive power. So this district magistrate is very strong. Even if you win elections and you can go and write laws, you don't have the authority to actually put them in place in a district. So it's against this colonial hangover of a civil bureaucracy that the panchayat system confronts. The panchayat system is a confrontational against this civil servant kind of figure. What they did was, panchayat system was a dream of Gandhi, who said that, in a new India, we'll have local self-government. Then the main government took him, seriously in that they had to take care of Gandhi, but they didn't put it into the constitution. What they said was, in the future, this is in the constitution of India, in the future we will have local self-government. So what the left did was, well, the future is now. Let's make local self-government. Let's be the true heirs of Gandhi. So they've used that opening in the constitution to construct these panchayats, where they hold local elections and local people run for office. Now, what has typically occurred in localities, you have landless peasants running, and you have a lot of teachers running. The teachers play a very important role for the left in West Bengal. Teachers are running. They come from sometimes petty bourgeois backgrounds, some from rural backgrounds, middle peasant backgrounds. They run, and so you have a combination of teachers and landless peasants who then govern through the panchayat. Even if their class background is not entirely, say, landless peasantry always, their sympathy, they are constrained by the locality, whereas the district magistrate is not constrained. So in that sense, you've actually been able to, create a political institution which combats the architecture of the Indian state. So that's the thing of how the panchayat functions. The question of the classes or the class differentiation, in 30 years that the left has been in power in Bengal, the cities have, of course, been a major obstacle until quite recently. And the reason this is so is because since the party has taken a very strong anti-war position, anti-imperialist position, etc., it's been able to draw in some of the middle class who are feeling increasingly alienated by, you know, what's happening in the world and scared by what's happening in the world, warmongering, rise of fundamentalism everywhere. You know, pay attention to the fact that whereas in most states in India, there's been religious sectarian riots, in West Bengal, there's been no sectarianism. And that's a very significant thing for India. You can imagine, you know, if the left controlled, say, Colorado or you know, Oregon or California, one of the states, and was able
one day.
To have a... Hello?
One day we'll get there.
One day. And then, you know, you have a state where there's no, where the question of race has been dealt with, not to subdue it, but where it's not a problem of battle where people are being killed. You know, if you don't, you say that in our state, we are going to have no police brutality and we'll have no incarceration. You know, you can imagine the symbol for the rest of the country. So that's been the call to the middle class. And this election, some middle class in the city voted for the left and left won a few seats in the cities. Same thing in Kerala, in northern districts, a stronghold of the All India Muslim League, which appeals to people based on their religious background. They lost several seats for the first time in 50 years, because the people said the left has taken a much stronger position against the Iraq war and against the impending war in Iran, we will support the left. That's what the feedback that has come back from there. First time in 50 years they won in those predominantly Muslim districts. So in that sense, there's been a reaching out. The problem for the Indian left is how to break out of these three or four states. That's a major problem. If we were, for instance, constrained to New York, California, and maybe Washington State, how to break out to the rest?
Vijay, I think you started to address it a little bit, but I think the overlay of both ethnicity, if you talk about either the Dalits or if you talk about religion, how does that play out in those three states the left actually has? Is it majority one ethnicity, majority one religion? How does that work?
These are all, I mean, India is a complicated place. These are all mixed places in terms of caste and in terms of religion. India was organized in 1950s based on so-called linguistic state principles. So Bengal is not because there's some Bengali ethnicity was the argument, but because the language is Bengali. That was the argument. But these are complicated states, not simple. Very large Muslim population in Bengal and in Kerala. I mean, in fact, in all states in India, there's about 10-12% Muslim population. So these are diverse states. In Bengal, during the worst period of so-called communal or sectarian violence in the rest of the country, in Bengal, the state apparatus locked down, and they didn't allow any of the fascistic groups to take control of the streets. You know, they arrested people when they came out to go towards neighborhoods and try to attack anybody. There was quick and vigilant response, which is what one has to do. You know, these fascist elements exist. They have to be shut down, and that's what occurred. Now, some people said, what about civil liberties? And I think they are entitled to their opinion. But when somebody is going marching with, you know, tridents, etc., to kill others, the state has to act. In other states, like in Gujarat, the state actually egged on the rioters, and you had the major massacre in Gujarat just 2 years ago. So that has given confidence, and that's why I say that's an opening to the middle class. One has to remember that in the rest of the country, there is also patronage systems that function, which the left has been able to break into and through the panchayat system. It's very hard in most of the third world to win electorally, because the political bourgeois parties that are involved have created these patron-client networks, and those are hard to break. You know, they give out to their favored people contracts for state business and such. And ironically, neoliberalism has broken the patron-client hold of these major parties, because the state doesn't have so much business to give out anymore. Ironically, neoliberalism, which is shrinking the state and therefore impoverishing people, is also providing an opportunity for the left to enter where the patron-client relationship used to preclude any left entry into those areas. Mm. You have to keep searching for opportunities, you know. Hmm. And this is a major opportunity.
And how has the Dalits or the Muslims, in terms of what is their participation inside the Communist Party?
Well, yeah, put it this way, the numbers of people that are involved are very high. You can't win elections in Bengal, or you can't conduct land reform without affecting Dalit populations. Dalit populations in rural areas are very high. And in Bengal, you know, there's a large number of Dalits in government as well, like the agricultural minister and others. So that's there. The oldest saw in the book against the left is that the left has not been interested in the social struggles. This is true and not true. The left has been involved in the social struggles, but the theory hasn't kept up with reality. Hmm. You know, in other words, if you went back and you read from the 1950s, the left-wing, political programs, it seems to be all about class. Meanwhile, the activists were out there in Tebhaga region and others fighting on behalf of tribals, for tribal rights. They were doing all this stuff in practice, but the theory was still about class. You understand? You know, they didn't articulate what they were doing or maybe enrich the theory. Recently, in the last 10 years, the left in India has held a few conventions, the Dalit Convention, a convention on tribal rights, etc. And I see a much richer engagement now with some of the other social movements. And I think this is the future. If the left does not engage with these social movements, it will wither. You know, so it's been very important. And it's nice to see that there's been this opening. I mean, with Muslims, for instance, there's no bigger issue in India than the fight against the Hindu fascism. That's one. And secondly, on the question of the international war that's occurring. And on both the counts, the left is very strong. It's ahead of all the other parties. So the Muslim support for the left has been growing. And it's the only reason why in India Muslim fundamentalism has not grown, has been that the left has been a significant player to provide a political alternative.
You're listening to Voices from the Front Lines on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. We're speaking with Vijay Prashad. Vijay, so I've got two questions, but the first one, and 3 minutes to do this in. The first question is, there are some on the left who really look down around electoral politics, and for those of us who understand even the limitations of electoral politics, we realize that there needs to be built, that we use it as a tactic, but that what's necessary in that tactic is learning how to build united fronts. So let's look at the Indian example in terms of how has the left, one, stopped it from getting isolated, and two, building power. And I understand that the National Congress now needs the left, even though it struggles from the outside. Explain that a little.
Yeah, you know, the first thing I would like to say is that one should never be dogmatic about anything. I mean, part of being, happy to say I'm a Marxist, and Marxism is a guide to action. So I don't think there should be one strategy for the whole world. You know, everything is
That's
about
right.
analyzing concrete conditions based on certain premises, theories, etc. So in the case of India, to say abjure the electoral path would be absurd. You know, elections is the way that there are still some openings available. You can still organize, you can still grow. That has been demonstrated. In the 60s, there was a debate inside the CPM, the biggest left party, about tactics. The two lines in the late 60s agreed on the program. They agreed it's a bourgeois landlord state. They agreed on what should be done to go forward, etc. Except one said that the state has suffocated the ability to grow electorally or legally, and they took to the gun. They are known as the Naxalites. And now they have been wiped out or marginalized and in many cases criminalized as well, and have become, you know, themselves preying upon each other. It's a very sad situation. So that has been their case. Meanwhile, the CPM has grown and has been able to increase the space for left political activity, which I think is a significant point, that a lot of other movements have been able to flourish because the left is there, you know, is a large organized force in government, that is to say in the parliament. They are able to raise issues which other groups bring to the table. So that's something to say, is that there was a value in pursuing as much space as was possible given the structure of class rule in India. That should be our basic question. Is there space to organize and operate? And you must utilize all the space possible. In India, recently, the Hindu right was in power. The Hindu right and the Congress party both agree on structural adjustment policies, neoliberal policies. Where they disagree is the Hindu right is anti-minority and the Congress party is a little more liberal. So the left decided to engage with the Congress to give them support in parliament, not join their government, because they'll pursue neoliberal policies. They created a common minimum program together. The Congress rules, the left supports them, and the left attacks them outside parliament. But what this has done in the last 3 years is it's isolated the Hindu right. The Hindu right is in disarray. It is fighting with itself. So in India, the funny thing has happened is that the Congress rules, the left is an alliance, and it's the main critic of the Congress party. So it's made a very strange position for itself.
Well, thank you, Vijay. I had another question, but I think we've got to cut this short. We've got the other program, but this is exciting to see. I mean, it will be interesting to look at this in terms of the strategy that they're carrying out and other revolutionary strategies in other parts of the world, particularly Latin America, and see if we can, you know, on another show, see if we can't look at the two of them and to see if there's any analogies. But thank you so much. We've been talking.
Always a pleasure. Take care.
Vijay Prashad, Associate Professor of International Studies at Trinity College. And look out for his book, The Darker Nations, The People's History of the Third World, coming out in November.